Three short pieces by Simon Wickham Smith. These are At Blackwater Pond, The Snowshoe Hare, and Sleeping in the Forest. And you said they were sort of, it came out and they were relatively complete. So when you were working on the others that were not complete, let's see if we can turn that back to those. Did you feel that it was an exhausting exercise to do them, to find what was right to make a piece work?
I think it was more of an adventure. I think what happened was that I would maybe get 5 or 6 samples and work with these 5 or 6 samples to see what bits of each sample work together. And then if I was using MIDI, I would see how that might work with these samples. And then I would focus and reduce. And then decide what I was going to work with, get rid of everything else, and then work with those, and then maybe even create a piece that was longer for whatever reason, because it was stretched or because it was there was lots of additive effects and events to the piece that would make it even longer than the original piece might have been had there been more samples used, but. The full effect really just came. It's like a dog worrying a bone. Right? you just go, and you know that I'm sure you know this. You know that there's this moment at which you realize, the moment at which I realized that either this is a good piece and can be kept, or it is utterly lost and has to be thrown away.
How often does that latter happen to you? Because you produce so much material.
Well, I think I would say maybe half of the time I'm throwing things out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you should get someone. Maybe you should get some friends to help you throw some more out. Just winnow those.
Not like what I've no,
throw it out in front of people.
Yes, throw it out. That's what we meant. Of course, throw it in front of people.
You have a quite a lovely long piece that we're only going to play part of, but it's quite a beautiful piece called Angels and Birds and the Coming of Night. That's actually relatively recent. It's only about 4 years ago that you wrote that.
It's 2005.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all MIDI. That is on... is it MIDI? Yes, it's MIDI. It's on, I just made some, just a few little drones and some jingles, and then I pushed them all together and then stretched them, and then you get this, and I have no idea how it came. You know, it's an amazing sound from the material that I created, and actually that's an interesting piece for what we were talking about, because I think I probably played around and tried to get a sound that I was happy with in the original material for maybe a couple of days, you know, all day just playing and playing and playing and deciding that this wasn't right and that wasn't right. And then when I got it, I knew this was the sound that I wanted. And then I spent another few days actually just deciding what effects were necessary. And what it actually came down to was simply stretching it. But for some technical reason that I have no idea, it doesn't sound stretched. It sounds like it's just long, sort of. Electronic, droney, noisy thing.
Yeah, I mean, as you pull those sound waves apart, the process of sort of deconstructing the sound wave creates artifacts, and those artifacts are very much their own kinds of things. By the time you get done stretching for a while, it creates a gorgeous effect. Let's listen to some of it. Angels and Birds and the Coming of Night, Simon Wickham Smith.
Thank you.
We're back from a sort of a meditative stretch here, and I think the topic is about to change a little bit.
Yeah, you had said that you are at heart a linguist, and at the time of this interview, you are out of Uxbridge at the University of Washington studying Mongolian language or Mongolian.
My study is in Mongolian literature.
All right, but you are, we presume you're familiar a bit with Mongolian or Tuvan throat singing from Central Asia. And I wondered if that has entered into your compositional structure at all, or if you have any interest in pursuing that, or if you know anything about, or if you can throat sing.
No, well, I can't. I've never tried. For me, my work in literature and in Mongolian studies is utterly different. I don't really combine the two at all. I'm the throat singing, the khume that you're talking about is interesting, and there's some interesting examples of it. But no, it's never come into my music at all.
Even the
Not interested in pursuing that in terms of composition. I think, when I was, for instance, when I was a monk, I decided to be a monk in the West rather than going to India or Bhutan or Nepal, right? And similarly, my music, I want my music to reflect the fact that I'm British, that I'm a Westerner rather than someone from another culture, because I'm really not at home with adapting very well other cultures like that. Although, like you've said, that there is the Jewish cantor, at least.
Which is
contradictory to what I said before.
Well, what I'm thinking about is that if you are so immersed in the language, and I would assume you'd have to be immersed in many ways in the culture in order to do effective translations, does the language and the culture and perhaps the geography in some way inform the music that you write over time? Even if you don't actually use the material therein, has it changed you, or do you keep them compartmentalized?
Well, I think it's fair to say that my music is probably the result of my exposure to Buddhism rather than anything else, or rather my exposure to initially to Catholic spirituality and then to Buddhist spirituality. I don't see any connection with my scholarly work at all.
Over a period of time, this compartmentalization will probably lead to multiple personality disorder. Just want to warn you what you may be looking
for. Yes, I'm experiencing that already.
And it's happened to us. Yeah. I'm really actually fascinated by your response, because this has been a discussion that has come up among composers a few times in the past year or two, that somehow in what we write, we can't escape the other occupations and the other ways in which we have time and place inhabit us. And I think it's the first time I've heard someone say, I think I'm more influenced by this experience than that one. And I go back to that question. Do you really become at all part of the cultural milieu in order to do your translations? I mean, even Western language, it seems to me, you have to, you can't do an effective translation of the sort of like the classic Le Bateau Ivre without having a deep understanding of French culture. How does that work for you?
I think you're right, but working on, working in Seattle or in Oxford or London on Mongolian culture is a bit like working on I don't know, lunar culture. It's like another world. It is another world. It's not. I'm not Mongolian. I can translate the text and I know what I'm talking about, and you know, I'm working on that pretty well all the time. But I'm not Mongolian. I'm not bilingual. I haven't grown up partly in Mongolia. So it's all very much secondhand. And you know, I do the best that I can, but it's, you know, if someone came along who was literally half, you know, half Mongolian, half English speaker, US or British citizen or whatever, then they would probably have a much better take on it. And then, you know, they would be as influenced by being Mongolian as they would be by being from the US or from the UK. And I think my, probably a better answer to your question than the one I just tried to give is that I can't really present myself as anything but someone trying to do their level best to translate a literature and a culture which is so foreign to most of us in the West, as you know, as really to be like Martian or lunar, or you know, it is really another world. If you go to Mongolia, you have a place the size, well, very, very, very big country. It's like most of Western Europe, with 3 million people, 1 million of whom live in the capital city, and the rest of whom are herders. Really, it's not. It's like Wyoming, but a very much bigger Wyoming.
And it doesn't have a certain senator and former vice president.
That's right. Yes.
Do you follow then in the sort of great tradition of the British translators of other cultural artifacts and events into English from the Egyptian cultures and the Central Asian cultures and so forth?
What do you mean by that?
When we study here works that are non-Western works, at least in America, most of the translations are British translators who have worked on those translations for many years, many even from the 19th century.
Oh, you mean, am I some sort of eccentric gentleman explorer?
No. Part of the great sort of British tradition of that. You know, are you a relic of the empire?
I probably am, actually. I guess so. You know, I mean, it amazes me. This is a kind of a circuitous way of answering your question, but it really amazes me, for instance, how at the University of Washington we have, you know, people studying religion, but we don't have anyone studying, people studying Buddhism, but no one studying Tibetan, for instance. And for me, the idea of studying a culture which is not transmitted in English without learning the language is—it's insane. It's utterly insane, you know. And I think this is maybe a rather old-fashioned, maybe a sort of purist way of looking at it. But you know, that might be a relic of my British education, I guess. I mean, I did classics at high school. I mean, a little bit of Greek and quite a lot of Latin. You know, and when I was at university, we did Old English and Middle English. You know, we had to learn the languages in order to understand the texts. And you know, maybe I don't know whether this is an answer to your question, but I think you know this to a certain extent has really been lost in the United States. You know, you have other benefits in the education system, I'm sure. But I mean, you know, this is one of the major losses, I think. And it's actually also happening in the UK to a certain extent now.
I think I was probably in the US one of the last generations to study Latin. I studied 3 years in high school, along with 4 years of French and some Spanish and Russian. But the sort of language teaching here, particularly classical languages, it's pretty much reserved for specialists at this point.
Yes, yeah, and probably for very rich kids in private schools, right?
I don't know any rich kids. Not then, not now. Let's listen to something else, and then we'll come back and ask a couple more questions. We have a piece here which we're just Yeah, I think we can play it all. Perihelion. Give us a little introduction to perihelion.
This is very dear to my heart, this piece. It's the first and only time that I've used the pitch bender to any real effect. This is an entirely MIDI piece. I think about three or four levels on a sequencer. And it's all with pitch bend, and it's all basically the same few tones played. I forget what the setting was, but it was... I have nothing really to add to that. I think it had no idea behind it. It was just, I'm going to play some simple tones and chords with a pitch bend and see what happens. And for some reason it worked. It's very nice. I would like to do a movie, a little short film with this, maybe of the sun, hence the name. This is what... those close-ups of the sun's rays sort of billowing out from the sun. I'd like to have a short film with that and the music in the background.
You mean those solar ejections?
That's it, yes.
Let's hear this.
You've got all the jargon, haven't you? It's good.
Let's hear, before we go further with jargon, let's go with perihelion. This is by Simon Wickham-Smith.
Thank you.
perihelion, Simon Wickensmith, our guest here on Calvus and Damien.
In the house.
And where are you going with your composition at this point? And for that matter, if you want to give us the two sides or three sides, depending on how many you have, with your various occupations, you're young, energetic.
I'm 41.
Well, that's for us, that's a whole generation away. So you are young and driven. Where are you going with your music and with your linguistics?
Right. There's supposed to be a CD coming out on a label called Tape Drift later this year, which has some new, a slightly new direction for me, which is, you know, basically piano music, but it's piano music put through a computer. And also the middle section of that CD will be a piece using a sibilant from the voice of the current United States ambassador to Mongolia, whom I recorded in situ last year.
Can you name him or her, or is that not permissible?
I'm not certain. Well, I mean, you can find him out on the internet, actually, of course. His name is Mark Minton, and he's a very close friend of mine, and he will be on this. There's a little sibilant from his voice that I used. And the other two pieces are piano pieces, put through the computer.
That's interesting, because something we did not play, and maybe we'll play it after we get off the air with you, is a piece called Cool Memories. And I listened to it, and I said, I recognize that sound, and so I played it backwards, and there was piano music. So,
yes.
So you have done piano transformations before. Is this sort of a secret desire to bring the parental sound back?
well, no. This is these two pieces that are coming out this year are me playing the piano very badly,
okay,
which is why I had to put it through the computer to make it sound slightly better. The Cool Memories is a piano sample,
uh-huh,
from a CD.
Okay,
illegally harvested, I think, probably. So that's going to come out, and I'm supposed to be performing in Seattle on the 5th of June.
And by performing, what do you mean by performing in this case?
I mean sitting in front of a computer and twiddling a bit.
Right, so you're doing live improvisation or live reconstruction of what you've already formulated?
No, it'll be an improvisation. And I don't know quite what it'll be yet.
And what do you use for your improvisational tools?
I use the computer.
No, I mean, what sort of...
You on the program?
Yeah, so some of our listeners will be intrigued to know what you're using.
Okay, so, I use two. Let me see if I can find them so that I can remember what they're called. One is called I Am the Mighty Jungulator. Don't ask me why it's called that. And the other one is called Lisa, which was developed in Holland, an organization, a musical organization called Stein.
Oh yeah, of course.
You've heard of them?
Oh, no, yes, yes, I was there. And
oh, right.
Yeah, and Stein Stein is one of the great centers of electroacoustic music, and in fact was in danger of closing last year. And and they did mount an international campaign of letter writing, which generated some 500 letters from artists around the world, and so funding was continued. So yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I know. It's a really wonderful place. And I had a residency there in 2000, I think. And I was able to fund the purchase of Lisa. And it's great. This is live. What is it? Live?
Live coding.
Instrument.
Live coding.
Sampling.
Yeah. Is it live? Like that, live sampling or live coding? Which are you doing?
It's like sampling.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I use. Those two programs, the formal program, I Am the Mighty Jungulator, which I think is the name of the band that developed it, basically allows you to manipulate six individual samples according to certain parameters, which I can't really remember right now. But and then Lisa, for having you know what that sort of thing is doing, the sort of science, this time development. So you know that really allows me to create two separate things happening at once. So two musical ideas for me happening at the same time, which is how I like to think of my performances.
Do you do these performances in concert settings or in clubs, or how do you work?
Both I've done in clubs and in concerts, but primarily in clubs because very few people want to come.
If
you have a large concert hall, you get like six people in the front row and no one else.
Have you affiliated yourself with the Seattle new music scene?
Yes, with Non Sequitur, and Steve Peters has very kindly helped organizing this. And I'm performing with a guy called Santiago Latorre, who comes from Spain, whom I've not met, whose music I've not heard, I don't think. But I guess it'll be interesting.
You're performing in sequence or you're performing simultaneously?
No, we're both.
All right, very good. Excellent.
Both. Yes, we cover all possible options.
I guess, well, what haven't we asked you that you were dying, a story you were dying to tell? You must tell our listeners.
If it has anything to do with your Catholic guilt, we already know that.
Yeah, we'll skip that part.
I don't have any of that.
Oh, so you think.
Yes, well, sure. I know you also asked me about the future of my studies, and that will just continue as it always has done. More translations and more scholarly papers, and I'm working on this MA, and so that'll be here in 2010, I hope, and then on to a PhD, all being well, while continuing to make unlistenable music.
We're listening. Our listeners are listening. Nobody's turning it off. Can't break the stream, after all.
That's true. That's true.
Simon Wickham-Smith, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's been very amusing.
Never that.
Right.
Never a dull moment.